amplifiers that were used in the cellular telephone service. The amplifiers are rated from roughly 870 to 880, or is it 880 to 890 megacycles, the transmitting frequency region for cell phones. That's what these amplifiers are used for. As I said, there's a 600-watt version, a 300-watt version, a 150-watt version. I'm not sure, but I think there's also a 50-watt version. You go to eBay, and you'll find lots of these things in the past, over the last few months, being sold, and you can bid on them. And sometimes the bid is $50 at this time, and you bid a little bit more than that, and you might win it. At the same time, many of these ads have a buy it now label, where you can buy the darn thing for $150, $125, very inexpensive numbers by my standards. When you get one of these amplifiers in your hand, and you take off the cover, the amplifier, by the way, is about 10 or 12 inches wide, about 3.5 inches high, and about 19 inches deep. Almost all of that is the heatsink. Beautiful aluminum heatsink, all enclosed with four little fans on one side, so that the air goes whooshing through the long dimension. It's got a great big carrying handle on one side. It's made as a plug-and-play, so to speak, for cell phone, direct modular replacement. It's got a great big multi-pin connector on the back, which supplies it the 24 volts, the RF drive in, the RF drive out, a whole bunch of monitor pins, and that's the main connections on the back. The conversion process, before I talk about conversion, the amplifier, as I said, has a 600-watt version, a 300-watt version, a 150, and I think a 50-watt version. My guess is that they were originally $5,000 or $10,000, and you can get them for $125. The date codes on there are numbers like 1998. By my standards, very modern equipment. Extremely state-of-the-art MRF 899 transistors. You go to the Motorola, you do a Google search on MRF 899, mic radio frequency 899, and you look at that data sheet. It's about a 10-page data sheet, and you're going to say, wow, I got to have one of them. 150-watt output. That's a boost of a transistor. And you get four of those in each one of these amplifiers. The transistor on the surplus market, if you buy 1,000 of them at a time, the transistor sells for $127 for one transistor. There's four of them in there, and you get that and a zillion other things for $150. You see where I'm going here. This amplifier has got five stages of amplification. You give it 100 milliwatts of drive, and out comes 500 watts. The 600-watt rated amplifier is 600-watt peak envelope power. I personally have seen 500 watts out of one of those amplifiers keyed out. Draws 45 amperes of 25 or 26 volts doing it. And it only goes down to 15 amperes of standby. It's class AB1 final stage. The amplifier, as I said, is made for 880 to 890 or 870, 880 in that frequency region. No retuning is required to make it work on 902. The transistors work anywhere from 800 to 1,000 megs. Beautiful transistors, MRF 899. So no conversion is required. You use it at 902 instead of 899 where it was designed, and instead of having, 200 milliwatts of input is plus 23, 500 watts of output is plus 57, 23 to 57, what are we talking about here? 30, I'm going to call it 35 dB of gain, 35 or 40 dB of gain in those five stages. When you use it at 902, and it was designed for 880, we'll say, instead of having 35 dB of gain, it's got 32 dB of gain. You got to drive it a little bit harder, and you get a tiny bit less power output. Minor detail. The amplifier itself is an extremely elaborate piece of engineering where the RF stages are simply cascaded five stages from input to output. It also has a whole lot of other stages added which do linearization feed forward. You simply remove every one of those. It's a simple printed circuit board, screwed down to the heatsink, you unscrew it, you unplug the connectors on it, they're all push-on connectors, you lift it out of there, and it's gone, nice and simple. The conversion for those amplifiers is done by Matt Bergson, M-A-T-S, he pronounces it Mott. It's a Scandinavian name. Bengston, B-E-N-G-T-S-S-O-N. Kilo Delta 5, Fox Zulu X-ray. I'll repeat that. Kilo Delta 5, Fox Zulu X-ray. You do a Google search on those call letters and or Matt Bengston and or amplifier conversion. Beautifully illustrated, nice Technicolor photographs. Well, this is what the amplifier looks like when you first open up the box. This is what it looks like before you open up the box. This is what it looks like when you remove three of the stages. This is what it looks like when you remove the five stages to simplify it. This is what it looks like when the stages you care about are left. And this is the way you rework the input connector and the output connector in order to do the full conversion. Very simple. For a guy of your technology, Doug, you're going to love it. That's on most of an amplifier. That thing's got hair in its chest. Beautiful design. You can't beat the price. You can't beat the gain. You can't beat the power output. You can't beat the fact that it's on a band that's essentially unused. You can have your own private frequency to set up repeaters. Do whatever you want. And other members of the family can use that frequency as a license-free communication channel if you want to. And you can make all kinds of wild combinations for these things. I think you see the capability of these things. Doug, back to you, because I think you're going to have a couple more questions, and you may need a fill on some of the jazz I just gave you. Kilo 2, Juliet, A2RIW.
All right, very good. Well, I switched rigs here. First of all, how's the audio on this one?
Beautiful audio. Please continue.
All right. Yeah, that's a tremendous piece of hardware, Dick, and I'm going to have to do some research on that. What would you say that's a very low drive level. What would you say the maximum drive would be without attenuators? Well, it's always easy to attenuate. It just comes to mind on that frequency. I did a quick calculation here. 100 feet of RG58 will give you about close to 14 dB on that band, but we're looking at numbers around 50 milliwatts to 100 milliwatts of drive for full power out.
Okay. You're going to love this. It's got nice plug-in connectors, push-on connectors on each of the individual printed circuit boards for each one of the stages of gain. I personally have done the following. I used the whole amplifier chain, and I drove it with 100 milliwatts. I think that particular stage, you could overdrive it, and I don't think you would damage it if you hit half a watt, but it wants 100 milliwatts. If you bypass the first stage by simply unplugging the push-on connector and push on and take your push-on connector that used to go into the first stage and put it into the second stage instead. Now instead of 100 milliwatts of drive, it wants a little bit shy of 1 watt of drive. So you decide how many stages you want to bypass to drive it whatever power you want to. You've got five cascaded stages, all with push-on connectors with little jumper coaxial cables between the stages. Unplug whichever jumper cable you want, and you can drive the last stage. Let me think now. The last stage gives a little bit more than 10 dB of gain, so 500 watts of output, it would need 50 watts of drive. So the last stage you can drive with 50 watts. The stage before that, I think you can drive with 5 watts. The stage before that, you can drive with 1 watt. The stage before that, you can drive with 100 milliwatts. Do any of those numbers sound desirable to you, Doug? Go ahead.
It sounds almost too good to be true, Dick. The fellow who designed this must have been a ham, foreseeing the obsolescence and saying, boy, this is going to be a great surplus item for the hams. Wow, I have to look into this a little bit further. But I'm afraid we're driving the price up, Dick, so maybe we should be quiet.
I'm worried about the fact that the people who are smart enough have sucked up an awful lot of these, but still there's a lot of them made. Motorola made all of these things, made zillions and zillions of them. They're all being obsoleted at many of the cell phone base stations and now updating to more modern CDMA systems. These were used back in the days when you had the more analog-like cell phones. These are the amplifiers that were supplying the power. As I said, they've been sold for 2 or 3 years now on the surplus market. It's been an extremely well-kept secret, as you said. And now they're starting to dry up. I think other brand names are starting to become available as other kinds of very similar cell site base stations are being upgraded. So I think you're going to find these around for some time to come. That's one thing I was going to say. The amplifier itself weighs 20 pounds per, the 600 watt version. The four output transistors, let me tell you what they are. Each of these MRF-899 is a push-pull transistor. There are two devices in one package. And when you follow the recommended application notes as part of the data sheet, it'll show you transistors being used for active bias control. It'll show you a push-pull network that's made as a power divider on the input and a power divider on the output of the push-pull transistor. When you buy this amplifier, each of the four amplifier stages in the final consists of four MRF-899s, which are themselves double transistors. So you can say that the real final is eight individual transistors in four packages. The amplifier itself, each individual final stage push-pull transistor, is built on a separate screw-down ceramic heat-sunk printed circuit board. It looks to me like it's co-fired, low-temperature co-fired ceramic. So you get this beautiful layout microstrip in ceramic for each individual transistor push-pull final stage. And if any one of them fails, and I've seen somebody replace one of those, you simply unsolder the leads going in, the unsolder the leads go out, remove the two screws, pry it off the heat sink with the heat sink compound, slap a new one in, and you're back on the air. So each of these transistor stages have this beautiful ceramic layout on an aluminum substrate board. The four stages have a hybrid combining network, which is done with quadrature hybrids, power dividers. Each individual transistor has got a power divider going into the pair of transistors that are in one package. But there's a total of four of those packages in the amplifier. Pairs of those have power dividers going into it. And then the two on the left and the two on the right total amplifier stages have another power divider. So you've got this whole network of power dividers going in, the whole network of power dividers going out. Beautiful, nice, compact layout all there, all supplied essentially free of charge. You're buying this amplifier at the price of one of the transistors, and you're getting only 20 times more stuff, if you know what I mean. Is that a bargain? Back to you, Doug.
YO? Yeah, station recognized. Sounds like about 10, 12 years ago when we were getting those Qualcomm boards for a good price. We visited again down the band a bit.
You've got it. I think the person said YO. I want to give me your full call and your name, sir, and then follow with your question. KQRIW. My name is Vic.
Call sign is K2YO. Name is Bernie Hunt. Vic, can you just repeat the Google search or the eBay search term for you?
Okay. The 600 watt version is called LPOP. Echo Lima Papa Alpha. That's the four letter abbreviation for the amplifier industry standard, so-called 600 watts. So there's an ELPA 600 watt. If you put ELPA plus 600 plus amplifier, I'm pretty sure you'll find it. There's a 300 watt version and there's a 150 watt version. I think the 300 watt version is called EMPA instead of ELPA. There, I'm not sure. But if you simply do a Google search for 600 watt amplifier, I know you're going to find it. 300 watt amplifier, I know you're going to find it. 150 watt amplifier, I know you're going to find it. If you combine the 600 watt amplifier and 880 megacycles, or 600 amplifier, 600 watt amplifier and 902 megacycles, you're going to find it. Also, by way of Google search, when it comes to the recommended conversion procedure, there you want to Google on Kilo Delta 5 Foxtrot Zulu X-ray. Kilo Delta 5 Foxtrot Zulu X-ray. You Google on that call letters plus conversion, I'm guessing. Well, just those call letters themselves. He hasn't published that many things. You'll find his conversion articles, beautifully nice Technicolor photographs of the before and after, and a bunch of words saying, do this and this. This is how you convert the amplifier from 880 meg commercial service into 902 meg ham radio service. So you start searching on those words. Now that you know what to look for, I'm almost positive you're going to find it, Bernie. Back to you, Bernie.
Thank you much. I was working on some other stuff here, and when you gave the search terms, I didn't write them down quick enough. So thank you much, and I'll go back to the listening of K2YO. I'm clear.
Okay, you probably have a couple more questions, Doug. And I think you see the capability of this thing. He's got all kinds of built-in protect circuitry. In fact, the protect circuitry is so elaborate. This thing is so good at self-protecting. It almost, at first, makes it a little bit hard to use. See, in the original commercial service, the amplifier had 600 watts peak envelope power, but the average power it was asked for is about 60 watts. You put 60 watts through the amplifier, it just cranks forever. You go beyond about 120 watts, and it suddenly goes into some kind of a self-protect mode where the gain jumps down about 10 dB. And you go a little bit higher in power output, and the gain jumps down again. All you've got to do on the control board is put a short circuit across a particular sensing resistor, and KD5FZX tells you how to do that. You put a jumper wire across the sense resistor, and that jump down characteristic goes away. You got to be a little bit careful, though. The one thing that Matt did not make, Matt, I think he pronounced his name, he did not make clear, is that the jumper wire you put across that sensing resistor has to be a very sturdy piece of wire. I did it with four strands of copper wire out of a piece of 8-gauge stranded wire. 8-gauge stranded copper wire. I took four of those strands, twisted them together, and used that to short circuit across the sensing resistor. At first you say, why in the world did you do that? Why didn't you do it with a simple piece of 22-gauge bus bar? And the answer is I did it with bus bar, and instead of it jumping down at the 60-watt level, it jumped down at the 180-watt level, but it still jumped down into a self-protect mode. As I studied the resistor, the sensing resistor, I soon figured out what's going on. The sensing resistor is something like a 0.05-ohm resistor wire wound, very heavily soldered down to a sturdy printed circuit board. You put a piece of bus bar across that, and you've made the 0.05 ohms go to 0.04 ohms, if you know what I mean. You haven't really made a delta. You've got to make a very sturdy shorting around those sensing resistors if you want the amplifier not to go into a self-protect mode. And the self-protect mode, when I say self-protect, it wasn't self-protect for damage of transistors. It was self-protect for the amplifier going into some high duty factor where the linearity would be compromised, and therefore there would be flooding signals into adjacent channels. This thing was very carefully controlled to make sure it had extremely high linearity, that all the signal of any one channel didn't flow into the adjacent channel. So that's the protect circuitry that you're bypassing. K2JJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Zach. That was my next question, and I don't want to take up too much more time here. It's getting late. How linear is this thing over a wide range of drive level? That's what I was kind of interested in. You said 100 milliwatts would be an optimal drive level, but you could bypass or add certain stages in there. I really should read up on this before I come back to you with it, but it does seem to be a very, very linear type of circuit over a wide range of drives. Is that true, Dick?
In its original application, Doug, with all of the feed-forward networks, which was an anticipatory circuit, no, that's not the right word for it, a deterministic circuit. In other words, I think there's a microprocessor in the original circuit for all possible temperatures and all possible drive levels. The amplifier, you could say, knew at the 500-watt level it would be in 1 dB compression, and at the 300-watt level it would be in a quarter of a dB compression, and so on. It knew that ahead of time. And so the auxiliary circuitry was another amplifier chain, feed-forward amplifier chain, that added power only at those drive levels in order to create extreme linearity. This thing had an extremely stiff two-tone intermodulation distortion test, an extremely stiff adjacent channel power ratio test, and so on. That's a very strict requirement. But to properly program it and use it in those modes, amateurs have all said, gee, I'm going to simply trace out the circuit, and I'm going to use everything. Well, various people said they're going to do that, and they started digging into it and said, boy, it's too complicated. They went to Motorola and asked for schematic diagrams. They got nothing. There are ham radio operators that work for Motorola, and various members of that group, the ham radio Motorola group in Schaumburg, Illinois, have been asked, get me a schematic of this thing. And because it's so proprietary and Motorola held it so close to their chest, nobody has ever gotten a schematic that I know about. So the hams have all said, to heck with this linearity circuitry, to heck with all this control circuitry. They just ripped it all out and used the amplifier as is. From the measurements I've made some time ago, this is what I remember. When you do all of the shorting of the right resistors and a couple more than Matt told you about, and you do the shorting with much heavier bus bars than he recommends, the amplifier will put out 500 watts, and my guess is at around 100 or 150 milliwatts of drive, if you use all those stages, it's about 1 or 2 dB compressed at 500 watts output. At 300 watts output, my guess is it's well under 1 dB of compressed. At 100 watts output, I'll bet you it's only a quarter of a dB compressed. By normal ham radio standards, that's extreme linearity by comparison to what you get with a Mirage amplifier. You take the 2-meter Mirage amplifier that's rated for 160 watts of output at the 160 watt level, I think it's in 6 dB of compression, if you know what I mean. And you try putting sideband through a Mirage amplifier, and boy, it can sound pretty horrible. It compresses like crazy. This amplifier doesn't do that. Nowhere near that amount of compression. So, by normal ham rating linearity standards, you won't have to do anything to this thing. When it comes to bypassing stages and feeding the push-on connector further downrange on those cascaded printed circuit boards where you use higher and higher drive levels, that's something I discovered in the experiments I did. The original conversion article doesn't say that. But when you suddenly realize that all these stages are coupled together with push-on connectors and short little pieces of flexible coax cable, you can decide how many you want to push, how many you want to bypass for the particular drive level you got. It is my guess that as you bypass more and more stages, you'll pick up a little bit of increase in linearity. One of the things you'll discover is that the final transistors, the MRF-899, beautiful data sheet for them. The input transistor, beautiful data sheet for it. The intermediate stages are a Motorola special for which nobody has the data sheet. Nobody on planet Earth that I can find. And I search pretty hard. I believe they are specially chosen transistors for high linearity. That's part of why when you use the whole Don amplifier, you do get a little bit of compression at max power output, but boy, it isn't very much. When it comes to solid-state amplifiers in linear service, I think you've got to go a long way to find one that's more linear. Back to you, Doug.
Yeah, very good, Dick, when you were repeating those numbers of compression, saying, boy, that would make a great sideband amplifier. Well, I'm going to do some research and see what I can come up with, and maybe do a little shopping if we haven't driven the price up too high yet. So thank you, Dick. Another project for the mill here. Appreciate all the time. I'll let you and Mel carry on. I'll be listening along. K2JJ, back to Ned.
Okay. Anyone else with any questions for the TechNet before we go back to some of the previous subjects? Give me your call letters and name right now. There being none, I think. Frank, did you have any additional information? Or Mel? Again, yeah, it was Mel. Mel, you were going to tell us a little bit more about what happened, I guess, in either Coney Island or the conversion to where Manhattan Beach is right now. I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess that portions of Manhattan Beach were part of an amusement park at one time, or a recreation area. And so, some number of years ago, maybe portions of it became residential. You happen to live in the neighborhood, so you probably know an awful lot about it. H-U-K-E-Y, H-U-R-I-W.
Oh, yeah. quite a story. Why? Yeah, Doug, I guess you got your project cut out for you this winter. Doug and I have communicated back and forth via email about modifications. He has a transmitter, an HF transmitter, same one that I happen to have. It's called the KWS-1 that recently came into possession of. And we were talking back and forth about modifications to it if he wanted to bring it up to the standards of today, you know, the ultimate of today's amplifiers, linear amplifiers, and all what, you know, a number of different changes he can make, but he basically is like to get it on the air. He's got a major project he's going there to change or repair the blower assembly, which is somewhat of a project in itself. Okay, Doug will be out of, will stay out of trouble with that. As far as the speech goes, the history goes back quite a number of years ago when it was owned, good air, part of this area was owned by a gentleman. I should qualify the gentleman. I'll tell you why. His name was Corbett. And in fact, there's a street nearby here named Corbett Place. They wanted to change the name to Corbett because he has a very dubious past. He was an anti-Semite of the worst kind. And basically, he did have a lot of clout. In fact, he originated the, I understand, was responsible for the building and owned the Long Island Railroad for a while. So he was quite quite up there, as they say. Here in Manhattan Beach, he had built a thing called a hotel, which was right along the water here. It was quite a resort for wealthy. You got to remember, one time Manhattan Beach was completely disconnected. It was actually like an island. It was actually called Manhattan Beach Island or Manhattan Island. Or, no, you couldn't call it Manhattan Island. It was first New York City, I guess, Manhattan Island. All right, we call it Manhattan Beach Island or whatever. It was completely disconnected, you know, from land. It was still been eventually that made it, you know, a direct connection to Brooklyn. And one time it was actually part of Long Island. They actually considered more of a part of Long Island than Brooklyn. And the Manhattan Beach Hotel, right along the water here, he owned all that property there. And, along came many years later, came the city of New York, and this was during Mayor Lindsay's administration, and there was a lot of politicking going on, and they wound up, they built the public beach here, much to the chagrin, as they say, of the locals here. They tried everything to buy up that piece of property and turn it into mansions, housing, you know, of the upper. They even were talking about making it a private community, gated to private community and all business like that, but it wound up a public beach. So that's really basically what went on here in Manhattan Beach. Also, there was one more thing of interest in Manhattan Beach, where the street I'm on, when they opened the street here some years ago, they dug up the street here, there was a number of these I guess they can call my railroad track. Very curious what the heck they were for. During World War I, they built the barges that were towed across the Atlantic Ocean to contain all kinds of materials. They put the barges together here, and those were the slides that flew them down to the ocean here, down the block. So it was quite interesting when they opened up the street because a neighbor of mine who collected old beer bottles for some reason. He found a lot of old beer bottles going back to the last turn of the last century. All kinds of strange things, you know, people discarded that workmen, I guess, would move to the dirt. So, especially, I looked at them, I said, they are odd-looking beer bottles, but I was happy enough that he gave me a hand, and that's when my radials all went down, my hundreds and hundreds of radials. Hundreds of feet of radio, thousands of feet of radio, I should say, got buried here beneath Dover Street. So that's basically the history of the briefly take over.
Now, once again, did Dover Street have these railroad tracks or trolley-looking tracks going down it at one time that could cover it over with asphalt?
Yeah, Roger. They, 1900, early 1900, just leading up to World War One, they had the track for here. You see, this is all raised up. They filled it in, raised everything up here somewhat because it was really basically at sea level. So they would be able to slide the barges. Were built, I guess, the old wooden barges that were assembled. And they slide them right down these track assembly, right into the Atlantic Ocean deck over.
What year approximately did you move into Dover Street, Mel?
The 1975. Go by my daughter. My older daughter was born 3 years after. So 33 years ago, approximately, around 33 years ago, okay, so
the reason I ask that is because I'm asking, where were you during the Lindsay snowstorm? I was in Vermont skiing with my wife. I think it was around February of 1967. And they called it the Lindsay snowstorm because he could have called out people on overtime to get a head start on the snowstorm, and he decided to save money. Made a good decision. But Mother Nature didn't cooperate. Boy, was that one hell of a snowstorm. It took me, first of all, the ski area I was at announced the fact that, hey, New York City is all boxed up with snow. Don't even bother wasting your time. So we stayed and skied another day. One day later, I decided to drive home. That drive home, which normally would have taken 6 or 7 hours from northern Vermont, I think it took 25 hours. And we had to go up and down various parkways in the wrong direction, drive through parking lots. I mean, there was snow backing up everything everywhere. Where were you during that event, Mel? Go ahead.
That time I was working in the city, so the subway system. It was something, and I'll tell you why. The subway rides underground to about Prospect Park. And then it goes in this, you know, sort of trenched out area that they have. The subway is sort of like trenched out there, but open. And actually comes out of the tunnel, out of the low underground. And the subway was running, and then it got stopped. Somewhere around, let's see, I lived on that time, I lived on, boy, I lived on the 7th Avenue. Right. Subway stopped, didn't go as far as King Tide. I think it was around Avenue M, like Mary. And everybody, we sat there, and finally, it stopped at the station there, and safe, never moved. And finally, they said, you may as well get off. And all, I said, get off, what? There's a blizzard here. Well, not much we could do. I said, oh my Lord, what do I do now? And I got off there. Now this, I had to go to Station Avenue, M-N-O-P-U-R-S-E-U, so a bit of a, and then over 10 blocks over. Well, Dick, let me put it to you this way. That was, I was not really dressed for it. I did have good shoes on. I did have my boots on because they had threatened, you know, that there was snow, and I had dressed moderately for it. But I'm going to tell you something. I really did. I thought I was, in the Klondike or something. Yeah, I came home. I was really frozen to death, literally. Took me, I'd say, better than 4 hours of walking. Yeah, better than 4 hours of walking. I came home. It was dark. It was maybe 8, 9 o'clock at night, and I was literally one step away from just complete numbness. It was an experience that you don't soon forget over.
And home for you was, I think you said Avenue U in Brooklyn is what I think you're saying. And so I guess the subway, when it came out of the trench, was about to become an elevated And there the snow was so bad the subway couldn't proceed. Is that approximately what happened?
Not elevated. It's like a dugout area. In other words, it's below ground, the subway, when it rides along for a distance and then starts to come up to ground level. It's not elevated anywhere, the subway, from, say, after it comes out of the tunnel. It's partially below ground level and then gradually rises up to ground level. It's elevated, but not an elevated subway. It's a dirt. In other words, they elevated it with dirt. They raised it up higher than the houses, the street itself. But it's not as, you know, what you picture the elevated subways of we have some parts of Brooklyn. This is just above ground, I'll say, Dick, over.
And which subway was that? Was that the IND? And what letter train was this, Mel?
That was the old BMT. Oh, where they put the bike line. BMT, and it was riding local. There's an express train that goes, but nothing. I think what it was, I was most likely on the last train to get there. I think that was it, because the whole system just shut down. I mean, never in the history of New York City in modern times, maybe you go back to the 19th century or so. But nowhere in modern times do we ever see a city. Everything just come to a dead, literally a dead standstill, Dick. We were really in it almost reminds me of a way like what happened to New Orleans during Katrina, over.
BB2BXL.
Go ahead, Frank, and tell us what you saw. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that subway line also. Which year's storm was that, Mel? That happens even today in just about every storm, including heavy rainstorms over in that, the trench there on the, what is now the B&Q line.
Yeah, we're discussing the so-called Lindsay snowstorm, which I think was February of 1967. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, that was the one, the big one, the Lindsay snowstorm. That's a fact. The reason he never got reelected, never got elected to anything. That was his the anchor that pulled him down. There was a lot of controversy about him being mayor, but that finished him off for sure. Because he entrusted supposedly with one person that supposedly has to give the orders. I don't understand that. Now, if that person didn't give the orders for the street cleaners to go out and stop moving snow, that nothing moved. And this guy, he was with you. He was skiing, Dick, over.
Yeah, the Lindsay that I knew, I think he was a fairly straight arrow, pretty nice guy, meant well. He either wasn't in town at the time, maybe he was out skiing, or the person that was appointed with the responsibility was out skiing, one or the other. And whoever it was made a call. And the normal call would be, hey, you bring people in on a weekend, on overtime, and you're going to pay a lot more money. And the city was having trouble running into the black these days, in those particular days. So he made a call saying that I'm going to save the money, and as soon as the normal work hour shift comes along, we'll plow out. Well, that didn't work, because the snowstorm was so bad, people couldn't get to their place of work. They couldn't get to the machinery that was supposed to plow the snow. So if the skilled workers couldn't get there and the snow didn't get plowed, you got a real rundown condition. And I'm guessing the BMT subway you're talking about stopped because in those trenches there was no roof over it to keep the snow off. I'm guessing the snow piling up on the track and particularly piling up on the third rail means that the train, the wheels could no longer make contact steel to steel to complete the circuit, and or the third rail couldn't make contact, so therefore the subway train couldn't move. Is that close to what you think happened, Mel? Go ahead.
No doubt. That trench filled up with snow, really. You know, it blew in there and everything just came down, and that was it. The train just, for whatever reason, it just stopped. And I was fairly lucky, to say the least, because a friend of mine wound up literally in a hospital from it. He was trapped on the Long Island Expressway out your way somewhere, and that became so bad on the Long Island Expressway that he was stuck in his car and eventually ran out of gasoline, kept starting the car up to warm up, then eventually ran out of gasoline. And when they got to him, he was near, literally, almost frozen to death. He spent, I believe, somewhere close to 30 hours or more on the Long Island Expressway, trapped on the Long Island Expressway in his car. I mean, there were cars, literally, I know, I saw the pictures, all over the place, along the parkway. It was a total disaster. Well, there's the chief, whatever you want to call the Department of Sanitation at the time, commissioner, I guess that's the right word for the commissioner, was off on a ski trip, and he couldn't be reached, and he was the guy who had to say, hey, guys, get the plows out, stop working, do things and all. So I don't understand how it spread out to the island. You know, it didn't also affect New York City, but it seemed like it spread out because these people were out on the parkway, out towards the island, were having the same situation. Traffic just backed up or whatever, and then they got trapped there. For some reason, they couldn't do even anything with the parkway to take over.
Yeah, almost the same amount of snow fell on Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. Almost the same amount. So on the second day of the Lindsay snowstorm, my wife and I get in our car and we start heading south. And as we go through Vermont, each individual town, each individual community has its own private snowplow volunteers who were plowing the roads. Same thing was happening in Massachusetts and Connecticut. The drive all the way down was fairly simple. I hit New York City line and you thought you hit a brick wall. The first thing I hit was the Tappan Zee Bridge, which was completely closed. And everyone is being told, go back north and find lodging. We did a little bit of telephone calling, realized that we'd have to go all the way back to Vermont to find lodging. And that didn't sound right. My wife went inside to the building by the Tappan Zee Bridge and talked to people real nicely. And he gave us permission to go over the Tappan Zee Bridge, which is officially closed. But we went south on the northbound lane. That was the only one that was partially open. One set of wagon wheel tracks through the snow. So they opened up the gate for us, let us go the wrong way. I seem to remember going south of the northbound lane of the Tappan Zee Bridge. That got me into Queens. And after that, we had to go through parking lots. We had to go through backyards of supermarkets. We made a couple of trips on various parkways, on the wrong lane, in the wrong direction. One time I followed a set of tracks that looked like it was going great, and all of a sudden it ended with a vehicle that had been abandoned. And I had to turn the vehicle around, and I think I had about 3 feet of snow everywhere. And the vehicle was really stuck. I used the bumper jack to raise the car, push it over, then moved it about 5 degrees, keep repeating that process, until the car got turned around. And then we retraced our tracks and finally tried another process. So I got down from Vermont to New York City line in about 6 hours. It took 21 more hours to get from the New York City line to my then house in Smithtown. My goodness, was there snow. People trapped all over the place with abandoned vehicles all over the place. It was quite a mess. I'm not sure, but if I had to make a guess, what would you guess? 27 inches of snow flowed during that particular storm, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't remember. It's K2, KTY. It was quite a bit of snow. Yeah, it was 20-plus inches of snow. We've had bad snowstorms. You know, since then, we had one, what, last year, the year before, we had about 30 inch and all. Sure, but they were, you know, warned that there would be a snowstorm. Equipment was ready to go. The salt trucks are ready to go. You know, you keep after it. As soon as it starts, you begin salting right away. You begin plowing right away. No problem. But you're going to just sit there and just let it accumulate. You can well imagine what's going to happen, especially where I am here. This is bad here. I'm on a dead-end street in Brooklyn here. And this gets the last one to ever see a plow. and a couple of times, in fact, one time, I remember years ago, we got a private company came in, we hired, at that time it was so bad, we hired a private plow to come down the street and just push the snow up against the end here by the ocean. It was here on this street. I remember the kids outside we dug out the street, and they were admiring that the snow is higher than they were tall. It was really something. We made snowmen right in the middle of the street. It was really something. So if you have, of course, got the equipment and everything, and you've got the warning, you got to, be ready to put it into operation. That's the whole thing. There's where he fell down on the job. He trusted one person. This one person should know that, that this time of the year of February, January, February is the time of snow. And be ready. But I think we'll go up on a ski trip, Dick, over.
The other really big snowstorm south. Okay, yeah, Frank, we're going to go in a second. The only other really big snowstorm I remember is the blizzard of 47 or 48. I think it was 47. I know you were exactly 7 years old. Where were you during the blizzard of 47, Mel? Okay, yeah. Maybe Mel got called away. Stand by a second. Frank, go ahead with your comment.
Maybe Mel was with his first girlfriend and doesn't want to say. Anyway, that's right in line that Mel was talking about. That is still a problem. Every snowstorm, every rainstorm, the Transit Authority cannot clear out that cut. They have no way to do it. There's just no place for the snow or the rain to go. So though the other, I guess it's the F train, which is completely elevated for the whole run until it goes underground, just about never stops in any weather, Coney Island to Park Slope, where it's overground. The beach, the B and the Q train, the Brighton Line, always dies in bad weather. It's almost guaranteed. It's and one of the first line in the city to go down in bad weather. And the most recent 30-inch snowstorm, by the way, probably with the exception of the, oddly enough, even the Brighton Line ran the next morning. That was a very different experience, partly because the heaviest snow was in very isolated areas. Much of Brooklyn only had 10 inches, a place where the, Weather Service measured had 27 point something inches, so by a few tenths of an inch it eclipsed the storm of 47 and the Lindsay storm, which was somewhere around 25 inches, but a much worse experience. So a lot of factors seem to go into it besides just how much snow the Weather Service measures. And by the way, even in 1968, didn't you have a VHF radio in the car or a 75 meter radio in the car? Dick, go ahead,
WB2BXO. No, I didn't. I should have, but I didn't. I was just starting to get heavy into VHF, but I had nothing in the vehicle at the time, sorry to say. FM repeaters hadn't caught on yet, not in the early 60s. Seems to me like it was the late 60s when they started catching on, two-meter repeaters. There were a few progressive guys just starting to experiment with putting taxi cab brakes into their car in the very early 60s is when that was going on, from my point of view. That BMQ line, as it used to be, the Biden, the BMT line, where it's got that trench that fills up with snow. Has anyone ever, to your knowledge, Frank, proposed putting some kind of a roof over that area so the snow at least doesn't fall into the trench? Go ahead.
You try to do anything on a subway line there, and you got to spend a couple of million bucks to get some consultant to write an environmental impact statement before you do anything. I was watching a short video today on creating the Long Island Railroad connection to to Grand Central. And the tunnel under 63rd Street already exists, but it's going to take until 2014 or 2013 to actually complete the connection to Grand Central. Give you an idea how big a deal it is to do anything with a subway line.
Yeah, there's a man who recently wrote a book as to what would happen if New York City was abandoned for whatever reason. In an extremely short period of time, the subways would all fill up with water. Now, one of the things that's not very well known is that the subways are continuously being pumped. The water that wants to flow into the subways is continuously being pumped out, very similar to what goes on in New Orleans. New Orleans is below sea level, and every time it rains, you've got to pump all the water out of that city. And I think, I suspect in a fraction of a week, the subways would be underwater if the pumps were not running. Have you ever heard about that one, Frank? Go ahead.
It's entirely possible. every couple of years in August, which is when we have very heavy thunderstorms, tend to have the heaviest thunderstorms around here, the subways go belly up at rush hour in the morning when a thunderstorm passes through. It just happened this August. And I think it happened 4 or 5 years ago in August when you get a couple of inches of rain in less than an hour, which exceeds the speed at which the pumps can clear it out. They're sort of like the bilge pumps on a ship. And the subways give out. So that's entirely possible. I don't think I've heard that before, but maybe I have. It's quite plausible, Dick. Ahead.
With a heavy rain, how is the water getting into the subway? Do the sewers in the street somehow dump into an area very close to the subway?
Well, it gets in through the trenches, like on the Brighton Line. Gets in through sewers, gets in through vents. There are a lot of openings. Every subway station has a bunch of staircases and openings that water just pours down. Loads of emergency exits. From the subways, water just pours down, probably from the sewer system also. The whole thing is very porous. That's why subway stations in New York, with a few experimental exceptions, have never been air-conditioned.
Water table.
Yeah, I think the subways are below the water table, aren't they? Mel, go ahead.
Sorry, I had to answer the telephone bell of my daughter. She's been listening. She sent out the cell phone. She wanted to make a comment that she said, well, we lost the other one. my other daughter, the younger one, disappeared behind a snowdrift, and we couldn't find her. So she just reminded me she's working on the banner there at church. The water table, a lot of places, the subway, you know, the water table has risen over the years. At one time, Brooklyn, I guess New York, most of it, now depending on well water, they pumped a lot of water out of the aquifer. And then, of course, when they went to the reservoir system and all, the number of wells have been closed down. In fact, there's not quite a number of wells that are here, that are drilled, that are sealed off. And it's supposedly just in case we ever have an extreme emergency, we have a drought for indefinite time, that they can stop pumping water out of those wells again. The pumps and other everything, in other words, everything is ready to work. So in the meantime, the water level has risen. So there, I can say there's a number of the subways. Oh yeah, they would be flooded out because that's the only thing that's keeping those subways from being flooded out is the pumps are running continuously. Dick, over.
If there was enough money, it sure would be nice to install some dry wells on each one of the staircases in the subway. If water can pour directly from the street during a heavy rain down the staircase and then into the subway, and it exceeds the level rate at which it can be pumped, it'd be nice to have some dry wells. I will admit that once the subway is fully established as it is right now, to suddenly do the digging required to install the dry wells would certainly be very disruptive. And how do you let all of that traffic flow through Main Street while you're repairing the street? You know what I mean? It's a problem. We can think of ways that it can be made better, but ain't easy. it was easy, somebody would have done it a long time ago. I think most of the subway system that we're using, a lot of it was designed, what, 1915 or some number like that? You probably know better than I do. Go ahead.
Sure, it goes back to the day of the steam shovel, you know, really. Part of the subway, I think, extend back even before that. And they basically, how did they do it? They tore up the street, they dug a trench, and they covered it over. Most of Manhattan was done that way. But, of course, when it came out here to parts like BFT, oh, they just went right across the land, basically. Open area, piled dirt up, and stuck the tracks right on it because that so-called the elevated section of it that starts around, I don't know, what, where the elevated portion starts. So as you come off Prospect, then you still like below level, and then gradually rises up around after H or so, and sort of rises up to a little higher than the street level. The reason for that is so that, yeah, it's actually the path underneath, and here's a funny thing, Dick. If you have an 18-wheel truck, you know you can't get to this section of Brooklyn unless you make a huge detour because the height underneath all the elevators, you know, the train, the DMT crosses all the streets, the cross streets here, is only about 11 feet 6, 11 feet 8. So if you've got one of these big trailer trucks, these trailer guys, my brother was involved in that scrap, and those trailer guys were having have to come down sometimes from state or wherever, pick up stuff. And they said, how the heck do you get over to that section of Brooklyn? They said that there's no clearance, and there is only one place. You got to go all the way up to a place called Forster Avenue. That's just where the train still goes under Forster Avenue. That's the place you got to cross over and then come back down this part of Brooklyn. In other words, you got to go miles out of your way over.
Interesting story. Wild. A buddy of mine once bought a 28-foot dish from my backyard, and we piled it on his trailer and on his pickup truck. And when we piled all the pieces, the 28-foot dish, 2,000 pounds of aluminum, made by the D.S. Kennedy Company, comes apart into 8 individual chunks. And we piled all those chunks as carefully as we could onto his trailer and onto his pickup truck. And one of the chunks, a little end of it stuck 13 and a half feet above the ground. And there's no way we could find to get that piece to be lower. And he lived in the Buffalo area. So he goes tooling out of my front yard, cuts down, as he's driving down the street, he cuts down the telephone line of the neighbor because it went across the street and it was about 12 feet up. He didn't know that, kept right on driving. And as he was going through Queens, one of the bridges has about a 12-foot clearance. And here he is tooling along at about 45 miles an hour with a 13-foot piece of chunk off the street. And when that hit the bridge, it chopped off that piece of this section of the dish. And he had to go back, pick up the pieces, explain to the police what's going on and whatever. Quite a rigmarole.
Yeah.
So the clearance of those bridges, I think you're saying many of the bridges through New York City, I think the clearance is around 11 and a half or 12 feet. If you go down the center lane, if you go down the right-hand lane, I think the clearance is less. You probably know better than that than I do. Well, go ahead.
This is K2KYYD. This part of Brooklyn, like I say, you cannot get to this part of Brooklyn if you've got something that's 12 feet. You're not getting under any of those underpasses. The train passes, you know, goes straight across from where it comes out of the tunnel area there at Prospect Park, and then goes across the streets, and they got the street, some of them dug down a little bit, like they dropped the street a little bit to get it a little bit more clearance. And that's the worst thing to do, because the drainage underneath those you know, sort of bowled out areas where the train goes above, the drainage is terrible, or garbage accumulates over that drain over there.